Good morning. Welcome back to the Roundtable. I'm Ray Graff in for Joe Donahue. 12 minutes after 9 o'clock. Time to begin this morning's panel discussion on topics in the news. Today we're joined by WAMC's Alan Shartok.
Hello.
A University at Albany journalism professor and investigative reporter, Rosemary Armeo.
Maybe.
Hello.
And political consultant, Libby Post.
Hi, folks.
Very, very enthusiastic.
Hi, folks.
That's better. You can join the conversation by emailing us at roundtable@wamc.org. That's roundtable@wamc.org. You can also comment on our webpage or our Facebook page, or you could tweet us at WAMC Roundtable. So welcome, panel. Rosemary, paging Rosemary, if you're in the building, come on down. We'll start with news that broke yesterday afternoon, early evening. Capitol leaders agree to a deal on the budget, quoting here from Jonathan Weissman's piece in the New York Times. House and Senate budget negotiators reached agreement Tuesday on a budget deal that would raise military and domestic spending over the next 2 years, shifting the pain of across-the-board cuts to other programs over the coming decade, and raising fees on airline tickets to pay for airport security. Both negotiators on the Democratic and Republican side promised an end to uncertainty and the lurching from crisis to crisis at least for a year. Both parties sought to preserve their ability to force another showdown over fiscal matters, but that's becoming just sort of standard operating procedure. Alan, first.
The question is the tail wagging the dog? In other words, since we know that that a lot of these Republican congressmen have been scared about having to face primaries from Tea Partiers, they have basically thrown in the towel and insisted that Ryan and everybody else, and Ryan certainly was complicit in this.
He was a negotiator, wasn't he?
Yeah, well, but I mean in terms of coming up with the philosophy of what they were doing, which is nothing. And thinking that if you threaten to close the government down, you're in good shape. What happened was people got disgusted. The Republicans and the Democrats got lower in the polls, but the Republicans, according to all the polls, did worse. So now they're making a deal. Well, everybody says, hooray, there's a deal. But one of the problems with the deal is that some of the things in there are not good, in, at least according to me. And I want to point out once more, I never talk for the station. I only talk for me. But one of the things is that I think it's something like $7 or $8 billion more in cuts for the people who need them the most, the SNAP program. And that is terrible. That's a lot of money, folks. And that means some kid is not going to get proper nutrition, and that's terrible. On the other side, in order to get them to go along with only $8 instead of $40 billion in cuts, they gave them a huge hike in the defense budget. And we need that like a hole in the head. I mean, especially when we're talking Mandela this week and reconciliation and not doing it the right way, maybe shaking a hand or two as opposed to waving a missile. So my take on it is it's good that they got something done. I'm delighted. But on the other hand, I think we ought to really read the thing to understand, how terrible it is.
I have one word.
What?
2014. That's what this is all about.
Sure.
It's about maintaining any kind of edge in the House for the Republicans. They saw the numbers. They saw how vulnerable they've become. And, this just happened so quietly and so quickly. It's clear that it's all of a political consideration looking towards 2014 to try to maintain their control of the House.
Yes, Libby, but it is a reversal of the of their perspective in terms of how to win the House back, which was that they were going to bring us to the brink. They were
right, because they were wrong, and they finally realized it.
Yeah, well, somebody finally said, put his hand up by the side of his head.
There's a lot of news about taxing on both the federal and the state level we're going to be talking about today, and I think all of it is motivated by elections, Libby. So what? That's the way our system works. They're supposed to be responsive to us, and I think it's wonderful that there's a deal at the federal level. I refuse to say it's great and congratulations, because this is really basically their job, which they haven't been doing for a couple of years, for two years now, and they're finally getting to it. And I agree with you, Alan, that there's a lot in this. It's all messy. It still feels very slapstick, sort of like the sequester. It's like, oh, we need to cut, so we just do it willy-nilly. And this feels very much the same way. What's needed is a sort of systemic look through the budget to find out what we should fund and what we should not, where we really can cut. And have to say, I think Andrew Cuomo is coming closer to that with his many little study panels looking at where money should go and how taxing should be made.
One thing is clear about this in that both sides have things that they don't like. Now, House Republican leaders yesterday have at least given some solid praise to this, but there are those, you know, the House Republicans who are more tied to the Heritage Foundation and whatnot, who say this shall not stand. And so even though the 2% Medicare cut continues to go through 2023 with this deal, they are, you know, I guess it's not a slam dunk this gets through the House, is my point.
I think it is.
Yeah, I think with Boehner and Ryan Ford, I don't see how it can fail.
I think it is because they're putting their leadership, you know, on the line. But these guys, you know,
that's rhetoric. That's campaign rhetoric. What Ray is reading. These are the guys who McConnell, for example, has to know it's going to go through. But he's speaking to his.
He's got it because
he's
got a tough primary there.
However, Libby is right, though. I mean, as far as 2014 goes, I think part of the thinking here from Ryan and the camp that wanted to get this deal done was, let's take away this shutdown threat so we can keep hammering Obamacare.
Yes. What's going to be interesting in the next few days, few weeks, is what the Tea Party folks say about this.
Well, they're already saying they don't like it.
Right. But whether or not they will actually fall in line, which they have sort of done, because the government didn't shut down. So it'll be interesting to see if they can keep their folks in line, even with this, with their public pronouncement that they've got a deal.
Well, Libby, you know, one thing, you make a lot of good points, but one thing is that the Republicans assume they're going to win big in the Senate. They're going to, you know, there is a big defense. And so I think part of it is that they want to take the Senate. And this is part of why the senators are generally much more
amenable.
Right.
The password is amenable.
Okay. But what also came out today was the poll on Obama,
right,
which is now improving because his fortunes are going to go up on the Obamacare, if that's the word you want to use, or the Affordable Health Care Act, as the thing begins to kick in and as it begins to work. Well, that's what happened. The American people punished him in previous polls, recent polls, because it was lousy. And now, as it begins to work, his polls are back up where they were, and they will continue to go back
up. Do polls really punish you? I mean, he's a lame duck president. What does he care if it goes from 20 to 30% in a week or so? I think we poll too much.
But it has to do with maintaining the majority in the Senate.
That's exactly right.
The Democratic majority and trying to take back the House. And,
that's right.
You know, in the first 2 months of the site, and I'm sure mostly in the last few weeks since now things are working, 365,000 people have signed up. You know, that's not 365,000. That's 42 million.
It's not even close to the 40 million plus that we talked about.
But it's 365,000 people more than that have health insurance that didn't have before, and that really does make it.
Well,
I see it as growing.
It is growing, and here's the point. When you went on before and you tried to get the Obamacare website, you couldn't negotiate it. Now you can,
right,
or you can for the most part. There are still a few glitches in it.
Alan, this feels like being really happy that the Republican House and Senate budget people are talking to each other. These are like basic things. Why are we sitting here celebrating?
Well, given the past history, I guess it's reason to celebrate.
I am only trying to analyze what the American people are doing when they give Obama higher poll numbers, which is they're saying, okay, you fixed it. We all mess up in our lives. You did it. You're off the hook to the degree that we are going to forgive you for this as long as the thing starts to
work. Or they could have just liked the dress that Michelle wore at a ball last week.
I don't think so.
The polls are,
I don't think so.
Put way too much stock.
We haven't seen what the question was. So, tell you what, Mr. Hopper, let's take a break and we'll shift gears. You're listening to the Roundtable on WAMC.
Support for WMC comes from Stone Soup Concrete, East Hampton, Massachusetts, specializing in concrete countertops, sinks, bathtubs, furniture, and architectural elements, serving the Pioneer Valley and New England, stonesoupconcrete.com. Handmade and More, New Paltz, offering a mix of American handcrafted and internationally made crafts and jewelry, plus toys, paper goods, and women's clothing and accessories, on Facebook. And Interim Healthcare, offering support for families during the holidays and year-round, with companions, aides, or nurses in the home 2 to 24 hours a day, serving the Capital Region, Saratoga Counties, Glens Falls, and Columbia. InterimHealthcare.com.
Well, hi, everybody. Welcome back to the Roundtable on WAMC. 922 is the time. Alan Shartok is here. Rosemary Armeo, Libby Post. I'm Ray Graff in for Joe Donahue. And this one from Capital New York. Alex Weprin, in a tight decision, the New York State Court of Appeals has ruled 4-3 in favor of Fox News reporter Jana Winter. Winter was subpoenaed in Colorado by the attorney for James Holmes, the man accused of opening fire in a movie theater there last year. Winter revealed that Holmes sent violent imagery to his psychiatrist, and Holmes' attorney, who believed the source was in law enforcement, was trying to get her to testify and reveal who leaked her the information. Rosemary, this would seem to be a big ruling for your side.
It is an unexpected and very happy for journalists. We journalists do a terrible job explaining to the public why these laws and these rulings that are pro-press are important for them, and so I'm going to try to do that. In this case, the Fox reporter, Jana Winter, got a policeman, apparently, to tell her about the investigation into the shooting in Aurora, Colorado. And Colorado officials are extremely upset about this. They want that leaker revealed. They brought in all the cops. They all testified. They all denied it. So the judge went along with the officials and said, yes, she had to testify. Colorado has no protection for use of confidential sources. New York does. This is the shield law debate. If anything, in this case points to the very big need for a national shield law that goes across the country. So what you have here is a New York reporter who was doing what she would do in New York with no problem, working in Colorado, where they said, you got to reveal your sources.
But here's the important
point. And the court
rule,
let me just finish this one thing, and then we'll argue. New York court ruled that, her protection traveled with her, and so she did not have to testify. Right. Now, the judge who dissented, who actually has a son who works in the media, has a really interesting dissent that's hard to disagree with. What does this mean if you're a reporter from New York and you go to the moon? You have the same rights. We have extraterrestrial rights.
Sure.
It doesn't. But it does point to the need for a national shield law.
And it also may be the basis of an appeal, since it goes across state lines.
Yes.
Yes, that makes it a federal issue.
Yes, it does.
And we know that the federal courts, particularly the one at the top, have been resistant to some of the more liberal ideas. Remember, the Court of Appeals
Absolutely.
In New York is a very liberal court.
Yes, it is. If this went to the Supreme Court, I think it would be in trouble. I hope and suspect it might not, because Congress is indeed working on a national shield law. This seems to be a matter that will be decided legislatively.
I wonder why congressmen are so, the ones who feel that the shield law is needed. Because it's right, or because they're scared to death of, getting on the wrong side of some of these reporters?
Well, and the shield law in this current iteration was pushed by Obama after he got in trouble for, following around, sneaking up on reporters, including one from Fox. Mm. I want to explain to people that the shield law doesn't make journalists, outside of the core. You don't get, unadulterated rights. But it does say that if you can find the information some other way, if it isn't absolutely germane to the case, then don't bother the reporters. Let them do their job. It's important for them to have policemen talking to them,
But Rosemary, I think we have to say why it's important. It is important because otherwise the public would never get the story.
Right.
The fact is, I've said it a billion times. I got into trouble along with you yesterday for saying it. But in the end, you can't have a democracy unless you have information. And here's a reporter who gives people information, but it's stultified. It's repressed by the fact that okay, now you have to tell us who the sources are. Once you have to tell who the sources are, you can't do it anymore.
This is part of a big national movement in the United States right now to shut down people who talk to reporters. This is they are out. Colorado is out to find the policeman who dared to talk to a reporter. Oh, woe is me. Talk to a reporter about a major national important case. That's not a crime, and yet it's being criminalized. On the other hand, the CEO of Fox, Roger Ailes.
Ailes.
That's fitting. gave this very hyperbolic statement about how, confidential sources are necessary for the survival of journalism and democracy as a whole. I think that's a little overdone. There are places where
especially coming from the CEO of Fox.
Coming from him, democracy isn't high on his list.
But Rosemary, you have it both ways? I mean, you just said almost the opposite.
No, I think it's a really important win. I think it's great. But you put out a statement like that from a journalist, a high-ranking journalist, and it turns off people. You just want this for your own advantage.
But a 4-3 vote on one of the more liberal courts in the United States is not exactly good news for the journalism community.
Well, let me ask you, Rosemary, would this not have the potential to advance your cause or your side of this more had she lost the case and then appealed and finally got it to the Supreme Court? Because if you lose in Colorado, then you say, well, this whole thing is based on a clamping down of First Amendment rights and free speech, and then you can take it to the Supreme Court. Now, the fact that she won, now you're dealing in cross-state lines issues, and that is not germane to what you're arguing here.
That's a good point. I don't know. This whole issue of whether the First Amendment guarantees rights to news gathering has always been clouded, since the issues began going into the court. So I can't imagine that we'd get a good ruling from the Supreme Court right now. I really hope that Congress takes the cue and starts getting serious about the law they're working on.
You think the Republicans in the House of Representatives are likely to pass this year, Lou?
Well, they don't pass anything, Alan,
That's not a good answer.
Yeah. I don't.
All right, so are we done? Libby, you wanted to weigh in at all here?
Well, I just thought what you said, Ray, was a little on the cynical side. Because it's like, are you glad? Wouldn't it be better if you'd lost so you can make your case even more at some other point?
To a place where you know you'll really lose.
Where you really lose. The fact of the matter is all of us who do advocacy, and you do advocacy for journalistic integrity, and I do advocacy for different things.
And I never
And you never do advocate for anything other than the station.
And as employees.
You want those victories. You need those victories because it's the victories that build the momentum. Make things change. Decision could very well impact what Congress is going to do.
Yeah.
All right. Well, no, we're out of time here. I would say that I was more pragmatic and less cynical.
Say pragmatic?
Pragmatic is a great word, and pragmatic was what I said. All right. It's the roundtable on WAMC, as you may have surmised. Let's take a break. Welcome back to the roundtable on WAMC. 9:36 is the time. The panel uproarious here in the break. I had headphones on. I don't know what they were laughing about, but I'm sure.
Better you shouldn't know.
I don't want to know. Alan Shartok is that guy. Rosemary Armeo is here. Libby Post also here. I'm Ray Graff in for Joe Donahue. So before the end of the last break, right before the news, Libby castigated me for my cynicism about the previous topic. And I said, well, no, I was pragmatic. So it's a nice seg into this segment. Cynicism versus pragmatism and expedience versus altruism. There was an interesting opinion piece in the New York Times a couple of days ago entitled Why Machiavelli Still Matters by John T. Scott and Robert Zaretsky. And we'll read just a little bit of it here. 500 years ago, on December 10th, 1513, Niccolo Machiavelli sent a letter to his friend Francesco Vettori describing his day he spent haggling with local farmers and setting bird traps for his evening meal. Typical day for the atypical letter writer who had changed from his mud-splattered clothes to the robes he once wore as a high official in the Florentine Republic. Skipping ahead, the prince is a manual for those who wish to win and keep power. The Renaissance was awash in such how-to guides, but Machiavelli's was different. To be sure, he counsels a prince on how to act toward his enemies, using force and fraud in war, but the novelty is in how we should think about our friends. It's at the book's heart in the chapter issue that Machiavelli proclaims his originality. And then, skipping ahead further, what would Machiavelli have thought when President Obama apologized for the fiasco of the health care rollout? Far from earning respect, he would say all he received was contempt. Mm-hmm. And so, is first of all, let's go to our political scientist. And in this day and age, not much has changed. Yes, Machiavelli's still as relevant as it was 500 years ago.
My two favorite philosophers, I don't like what they say, but I think they're profound, are Machiavelli and Kafka. And I have to tell you that Machiavelli is a very complicated guy, because you remember he was tortured. This guy had been tortured by the Medici and others, mm-hmm. because they suspected him. So he wrote this thing called The Prince, and he basically gave advice which seemed to be glowing to the people he wanted not to kill him or not to torture him. And he said, I think, above all, be pragmatic. Be pragmatic. Do what you have to do. Now, so that's why it gets very interesting with the Obama example, Ray, if you think about it, because clearly Obama is surrounded by his guys in the White House or women, and they're telling him what to do. And they're saying, okay, you got to go out. Hey, boss, you got to go out there and apologize and say you screwed up. And that will get you more people than if you don't do that. So to say that Machiavelli would not have approved of it, I think, is probably wrong, because Machiavelli would have said, hey, whatever. Whatever you have to do to get over, you do. Which is what he was doing when he was writing The Prince. Just one last thing, and that is many people think that The Prince was satirical in what it said, because he was afraid when he was giving advice to the prince that, you know, they'd put him up back on that machine and drop him from the ceiling down to the floor, which they had been doing with him.
Yeah, charming life he had. You know, it doesn't almost matter, does it, whether it was satirical or not. His advice has been taken and is still widely believable, yes, in the political world. And it is true that we like the really hard, mean, tough leaders. And not just us. I mean, this is throughout the rest of the world, too. Look at Jimmy Carter, who was a humanitarian.
Sure.
He told the truth. He spoke from his heart. He did all the things
his
that
heart,
you
where
wanted.
He had lust.
I had lust in my heart. Was he penalized for that or what?
He got killed for it.
Yeah, as opposed to, you know, Clinton, who lied and did what he wanted. And see, that's a perfect example. Clinton is much more, was then and is now, much more pragmatic, Machiavellian, than Jimmy Carter. We do prefer the Clintons to the Carter. Sadly, I think Machiavelli, satirical or not, is right.
We want leaders who lead. Yeah, I mean, that's what we want to see in people.
Well, show me a leader who a contemporary leader in politics today. See, that's why Mandela becomes interesting. But one could even make a case that Mandela was pragmatic also.
Oh, absolutely. And his reconciliation and forgiveness was a very pragmatic way of
getting the country.
Getting the country back together again. You have to do things. You know, being apologizing or being out front and using soft rhetoric does not mean you're being weak.
So show me a contemporary politician today who is not Machiavellian.
Wow.
There's not too many that I know of.
I mean, you know, I wrote
the
a
ones
column
who make
I got
it.
Into a certain amount of trouble because in the most positive way, I wrote a column called one of my papers put on the top of it, you know, Andrew Cuomo is the new Machiavelli. Well, they didn't like that. They thought that.
Who's
that? Well, I'm
leaders?
Not allowed to say, because I have these off-the-record conversations. They call me up and we talk about it. And the first sentence of which is always, believe it or not, let's keep this between ourselves.
Oh, okay. So we're talking about
which now you have not done.
Right.
No, I haven't named the name.
Okay. He said to shield his sources. Okay, we got it.
I haven't named the name.
So you're in New York State. Okay.
Right.
Okay. I thought you meant like readers didn't like it.
No.
Well, that's possible as well.
No. Well, although I didn't hear that. I only heard it. And they tried to make it into something different. Was it some kind of an ethnic slur, or was it this or that? No, I mean, I told them at the time that I have great respect for Machiavelli, which I just told you guys, and that I'd taken at least two graduate courses that involved Machiavelli. So I had studied him, and I knew something about him. But I think, as you said earlier, Libby and Ray, he was a profound, and Rosemary, he was a profound thinker. He was a profound thinker and knew what he was saying. And that's why I asked the question, which is, show me one politician who we can say is not Machiavelli.
I don't think they're successful if they don't behave in a way that Machiavelli would suggest. And maybe the real value of studying, taking graduate courses in Machiavelli is for we, the voters, to be aware that that's what our politicians are doing. So, for example, does it really matter as we keep saying, oh, they're only cutting taxes or making agreements to win votes? Great, that's what they're supposed to do.
That's their job.
But what's the greater purpose is the question. So Bill Clinton leaves office with tremendous popularity. He's achieved something that people like. Now, in order to get there, did he have to behave in a more or less Machiavellian fashion?
Machiavelli is pretty clear, isn't he, Alan?
Yes,
that
he
the
is.
Main job of a politician, of a person in power, of a leader, all apply, is to stay in power. He can't do anything if he doesn't.
And also
have
the
that,
preservation
that
of the state. Isn't that what Machiavelli also says? It's not necessarily preservation, certainly the preservation of himself, but also the state. And that's the bigger thing. But an interesting part of this opinion piece, and it's a great point, is that as American voters, most of us still want a leader to be virtuous, generous, merciful, honest, and faithful.
Well, we say that. We say we want that, and we hate them. We hate them when they're in office.
Ah.
Yeah. Well, we sure didn't like Jimmy Carter.
And we want, but we say that that's what we want, but we also want someone who will lead us and who will show us the way. And my one of the best examples I have of someone who was incredibly Machiavellian but was able to do the human touch when he needed it was Rudy Giuliani when 9/11 happened. We all know he was incredibly, I mean, the chessboard was his life. But when all of that happened, he became a human being. And
My vote would be FDR,
yes,
who was
absolutely
charming,
yes,
dashing,
right,
handsome, you
and
know.
Got the job done.
And he was, he ruled with an iron fist.
That's right.
I agree with you, but he was very careful not to lead further than the American people were willing to go. See, Giuliani ended up as not a popular character in our thinking. So, in other words,
ultimately,
yes, ultimately.
But that time frame.
Well, I mean, what were you going to do? This terrible thing had happened in the city. He became America's mayor because, you know, he reacted correctly. I remember poor Pataki standing there with his hat in his hand.
That's exactly
on the outside of the periphery. Giuliani wasn't giving up anything.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
mm-hmm,
in terms of doing that.
Right.
You
so,
know,
in a sense, he was playing out the Machiavellian playbook.
But in the end, it bit him in the behind. And the reason is that, for example, he chose to appoint Bernie Kerik, not only his top officer in the city administration, but then he wanted him the head of Homeland Security, and it turns out he's a crook.
Well, the one thing that Machiavelli doesn't talk about is the fallacy of believing your own headlines and the ego that comes with that.
Yeah.
I think the divide in America between saying we want good, holy, you know, generous leaders and what we really want was in Lincoln, who we've turned into a saint. And then Spielberg in his movie this past year showed that he was as Machiavellian as the rest of them.
Yeah, banging on the table saying, I don't care what it costs, how many postmasterships I have to give away, I'll do it.
All right, that's a great spot to take a break. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.
Support for WMC comes from Adams Ferriker Farms, Kingston, Poughkeepsie, Newburgh, and Wappinger. Fresh trees, hand-decorated wreaths, tree ornaments, Adams-grown poinsettias in multiple colors and more, adamsfarms.com. Boston Lake Pottery, Boston Lake, New York. Offering handmade porcelain pottery, vases, table lamps, place settings, and more since 1975. Wedding registry available, bostonlakepottery.com. And SUNY Ulster Online, introducing Fast Finished for adult learners with online accelerated courses for associate's degrees in as fast as 17 months. SUNYUlster.edu/fastfinish.
Welcome back to The Roundtable. It's our panel discussion this morning. 9:47 is the time. Rosemary Armeo is here. Libby Post is here. Alan Chartok is there. I'm Ray Graff. And one article that Alan, very concerned about today.
This story will give you heartburn.
That's very good. Did you think about that this morning, or did it just come to you?
Do you know how many Americans had prescriptions for these proton pump inhibitors. I'm one.
I do.
Libby's another.
I have it.
You do?
Sure.
Okay, so it turns out that 157 million prescriptions were written for what they call PPIs alone last year. Now, we're talking about, you know, all the popular names of you know, these,
yeah,
these the purple pill, Prevacid, Prilosec, Nexium, and whatever generics have come along.
Omeprazole.
Yeah, that the state prescription plan won't pay for.
Counter, isn't it?
The other ones.
Well, so anyway,
okay. So here's the deal. Here's what I love about this, Ray. Did you want to say something?
No, I was just going to read the first paragraph from the article.
That would be a good idea, because yeah. I don't think people.
Okay, so the article was acid suppressing drugs are linked to vitamin B12 deficiency. Our resident hypochondriac on staff here was up all night worried about this. People who use certain acid suppressing drugs for 2 years or longer are at increased risk of vitamin B12 deficiency, which can lead to anemia, neurological problems, or dementia.
Dementia, can you imagine?
Yeah.
Every time I'm going to be thinking about a word I can't remember, I'm going to be saying not enough vitamin, or as they say in England, vitamin B12.
So take some B12. What's the issue, right?
We haven't noticed any signs of that yet, Alan.
And our audience, by the way, are picking up the phones now, calling their doctors and saying, I want you to test me for a vitamin B12 deficiency. You know, one of the things I love about this story so much is we have an FDA. And before any of these things can be put on the market, they've got to go to the FDA. And the FDA has to say, based on our very limited experiment, you know, this is safe. But inevitably, it turns out that when millions of people use it, that's when you find out about these things.
Well, you know, here's the real problem with this and with a whole lot of medical reporting. It's like if you have heartburn, if you have acid reflux, you want relief right away and these pills give it to you. And now they're saying, oh, if you take these pills for too long, you're going to have a B12 deficiency.
You don't
want to
know how long they're taking.
What the heck is that? And even this report says a lot of people are asymptomatic.
Okay, now,
so
now,
I'll take a chance.
Let's put it in perspective.
Give me my purple pill.
Further on in this article, Dr. Joel J. Heidelbaugh, an associate professor of family medicine at the University of Michigan, commended the researchers for calculating how many people would need to be exposed to a potential hazard before a person is affected. If you treat 67 people with PPIs for 2 years, one of them will have a vitamin B12 deficiency, and a further percentage of those would have some serious consequence of that deficiency, but not everybody.
No,
so the sky is again,
others.
It's not falling.
Until it's you.
But we have medical study after medical study. First things are good for you, then they're not good. And you said this morning in your 737 commentary. You said people will be lining up to get B12 until someone says B12 is bad.
That's right. Until they find out B12 isn't good.
B12 is expensive. I was in BJ's this weekend, and someone inadvertently put it in. It must have been the guy ahead of me in line.
Yeah.
It's like $22. I got to bring it back to get my money
back. Well, you better keep it.
Yeah, now I will keep it,
For how many, though?
100, 190 caps.
I know a surgeon.
That's not bad. Yeah, that's not
I know a surgeon who is always trying to convince me to get a hiatal hernia repaired surgically. Because once that happens, are you listening?
Mm-hmm.
Once that happens,
we have strayed from public affairs.
No, not at all.
Okay.
Not at all, because this is something that affects our audience. I think it's a huge story, and I go to my gastroenterologist. He says, No. Those things don't really work yet. And so you have
what,
this
is the surgery?
The surgery. Yeah.
I see.
So now you have this debate going on whether to take the pill. If you don't take the pill, and the acid burns a hole in your esophagus known as Barrett's, and then cancer, and a lot of people die from it. The question is, would you rather be 1 out of 67, take the risk of being 1 out of 67, as you say, Ray, or of certainly burning a hole in your esophagus and causing cancer?
Gee, I feel like
what
I'm
a
having,
choice.
Well, you know, I mean, for me, it's like I'm having a heart attack.
Oh yeah.
In women, that's one of the things that I really feel like there's somebody standing on my chest, and I feel like I'm having a heart attack.
Well, it's interesting.
And I know it's not true, but
It's interesting because a hiatal hernia, you know, means that the stomach is basically, if I understand it correctly, it is not really tied in. It's not anchored to your body.
Ah.
And so save us
from this, right? My mother says the worst kind of conversations are people talk about their medical illnesses.
Yeah,
we're going to talk about their operations.
I could listen
next.
To Alan talk about his ailments all day.
No,
but wait. When you gain the weight, up comes the hiatal hernia. And that, my dear Libby, can sound like a heart attack. Can feel like a heart
elementary,
attack.
My dear Libby. Elementary.
Well, you know, I only take it when I need it. So, you know, I'm sure I'm not at that big of a risk.
All right. All right. I'm getting the gesture from Rosemary. We're going to move on.
What is it that makes you so uncomfortable about this?
She doesn't want to talk about.
We can save lives by having this discussion. I don't get it.
You know what? I'm with Rosemary on this one. Uh-huh. Only because I know
that
she'll hurt me.
Do you want to go deeper into this or not?
No.
Only if she'll hurt, you know. All right. Here's what I thought we'd talk about.
Yes.
We'll just continue talking about PPIs.
Sure.
Go on.
Maybe we should talk about smoking.
All right, here we go. So it's 9:53, 6 minutes to go, and I thought this was interesting. Libby thought it was not interesting, and I'll leave it up to you, the listener, to think if it's interesting and see if Libby's wrong.
Bye-bye now.
You leaving?
No.
Oh, the listeners are going
to
leave?
No. Just as a precursor to what you're going to say.
Oh, I see. All right. This is from CNN, and I thought this was fascinating.
It is.
Headline, 200,000 people apply to live on Mars. If you have ambitions, now Libby, again, shaking her head. If you have ambitions of being one of the first people on Mars, listen up. A Dutch company says it's moving along with its plan to send 4 lucky Earthlings to colonize the red planet. The catch, you won't come back.
It's like the movie Cocoon. It's a whole fictional plot here. It's fantastic.
Yeah, so, if it was a movie, it would be great.
I don't know.
Important than a hiatal hernia.
No, it's just more interesting.
This is a philosophical question, and I ask you to stay with us here, Alan. The Mars One Foundation announced Tuesday that it has secured lead suppliers for an unmanned mission launching in 2018, which involves a robotic lander and a communications satellite. And the plan is, if all goes well, the first pioneers could land on Mars in 2025. There's no way to get them back. So I ask you, our panel, in the remaining 3.5 minutes we have left, for the sake of humanity, for the sake of improving our chances of surviving in the universe, would you go to Mars and not come back?
It depends on what's going on here.
I applied once to be the first journalist to go into space. I did not get it, and you'll remember that was the Christa McAuliffe horrible, tragic flight.
Oh, yeah.
I think it would be wonderfully exciting if they would take a 75-year-old, and I could figure out how you apply. Yes, I would.
But a 75-year-old would not probably be
25,
able...
yeah. Well, why not? John Glenn went up in space when he was an old man.
Well, I suppose. But then you're not...
Yes, I think it would be an exciting way to spend your elderly years rather than on Earth, you know, worrying about hiatal hernias. Go to space and be a pioneer.
All right, that was a shot. Libby?
I don't think he'd listen to me.
No, you know, I heard it.
Oh.
He's taking notes. Libby.
I mean, look, if somebody wants to go, they can go. I'm not... not me, but... you know, I want to be able to come back. I don't want to end my days there. You know,
you wouldn't be satisfied that you're increasing our knowledge and science has and the human race has prospered due to your.
What about as a penal colony?
Right. I mean, my thing.
That's not
is,
a bad idea.
Yeah. You know, I just I like it here.
Okay.
Yeah. I like my feet on the ground.
But remember Jor-El.
Yes, I know. I mean, but I like it. I like going to Mars.
Jor-El.
And I like all that going to the movies.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You know,
well,
that's my
if this
idea.
World is about to blow up, maybe, you know, and you can get
the
a chance to
the
get
problem
on.
Is, you know, we're going to send 200,000 people there. Are they going to do any better job than we're already doing here? You know, what are they going to do to that plan?
That's what science is. You invest in science and development to find out stuff you
sure,
don't know ahead of
sure.
time. So would you go, Ray? We'll
would I out. Go? I guess, you know, I think if I had a terminal illness, I would probably do it. In other words, if I knew I had a couple of years left, I might do it.
What's the advantage?
What's the disadvantage? You're going to die anyway.
Yeah, but you have
you're going to die anyway even if you don't have a terminal illness.
What
right
would you
want
to go
moment?
Up there for?
Right. And tourist trips to the moon by 2043, does that mean they're going to be able to bring people back?
Then they can go back. You can
I would
wait
assume
till
it's all nonsense.
It's quite a bit closer to the moon.
It's all nonsense.
Well, it is all nonsense in that it's most likely not going to happen. However, it's a question I thought.
Well, but there are intervening variables, things like, you know, the North Koreans.
What?
Well, shooting you down.
You don't know what they're going
to
do.
And my attitude, I mean, honestly, there's so much that needs to be dealt with here.
Oh, you guys are so
serious. They don't handle hypothetical questions well, Ray.
No, they absolutely not.
John Weiss wrote to us, you know.
Oh, good. At roundtable at WAMC.org.
Yeah, as I started writing this, Alan pointed out Machiavelli was trying to avoid running afoul of the people in power. In fact, I heard that, quote, the prince was not only satirical, but meant as an example of how not to rule.
Right.
The prince was supposed to be an example of a bad ruler.
Okay.
Good point.
You got anything else?
Me?
Yeah.
Not
we have 30
can...
seconds left.
No.
I. Now that
no.
you've killed
what?
The Mars segment,
can we say, wait, I have something.
Right,
we talked earlier about the budget agreement.
Yeah.
Did you notice that part of the agreement on military expenditures was to drop entirely the warring amendments by our own, by Gillibrand, by our congresswoman, and by Claire McCluskey?
I did see that.
Yeah, they have agreed.
Why
that they're not going to.
Why did you bring that up at 45
because
minutes
ago? Because you guys talk too much.
Point.
I can't get
and,
a word
and
in edgewise.
Remembering what it was, which
the
was that.
Which was that sexual assault
right.
would
All
be
right.
handled
but
in a different way.
Now we have to talk about this tomorrow. Thank you, Rose. Mary.
Okay,
I appreciate
we have the
that.
First topic.
All right, listen, we're done here, and it was up and down hour, and we appreciate everybody for sticking with us. Roundtable at WAMC.org is the email address. Thanks to Rosemary,
if they
our mayor.
Did indeed stick with us.
Well, if anybody's left, just send us an email and let us know. Libby, thank you. Alan, thank you. Thank you for listening. Hour number two is on the way, and boy, is it great.